I want to start with a conversation about divorce. What do you think causes it? It seems like in your book you suggest that many breakups are for the better. How should one evaluate that decision, and how do you think about kids as part of that process?
You know, the research shows that when people consider divorce, they consider that decision for many, many years. What eventually causes divorce were problems that were there from the very beginning. And so it's important for people early in their relationship to really take stock of the issues that they face and make sure that those aren't going to come back to bite them later in the future. Kids are certainly, you know, one of those big relationship investments. Investments are those things you put in a relationship that you can't easily get out of or get back if you lose the relationship. The parents deal with divorce well, and it, you know, it's mutual, it's respectful. You know, they willingly embrace co-parenting. There's not a lot of arguing and strife. Divorce isn't as problematic for children because you can use that experience to model having high standards, you know, looking for the best for yourself. I mean, there's some positives that can come out of that too. But certainly most often the case is that people, you know, divorces aren't as amicable as we would like them to be. And so that when kids see that from their parents, that can be very problematic.
I have a 19 and 21-year-old kids. What advice would you give me to give them as they begin their relationships?
And the best piece of advice I give to college-age students is make sure your partner is your best friend. You know, we expect them to be kind and respectful and always there for us and to treat us well. And we need to make sure that we're holding our romantic partners to those same standards. The other really useful part of using this lens is it helps you emphasize the right kind of love. Typically, we spend too much time focusing on passionate love. Passionate love is that, you know, your heart's going pitter-patter and that nervousness, it's the attraction, the heat of a relationship. But the other kind of love is that kind of best friend love. It's that, you know, I really enjoy being with you as a person. You know, I like you. I like spending time with you. I find you funny. You're a great person to talk to. You know, that passion, as much as it's exciting to fall in love, that passion eventually fades. And if we place too much of an emphasis on the passion, we're constantly going to feel like we're falling out of love. Whereas if you put the emphasis on companionate love, your love is only going to grow and improve over time.
I got married in my early 30s, but plenty of people get married in their mid-20s, and my parents got married when they were 20. If you're 20, you're developing. People do grow. People do change. How should we think about change and individual growth in terms of relationships, and what are the extra risks you take when you get married young?
I think the risk is, you know, at 20, you're less sure about who you are as a person than you would be when you're 30. Similarly, if you're a 20-year-old marrying another 20-year-old, your partner's in the same boat, right? That they don't know themselves as well as they're going to in another 10 years. And so if you have two people who don't know themselves as well, you're just heightening the degree of difficulty for the likelihood that you're both going to grow in similar and desirable, mutually beneficial ways over the next 10, 20, 30 years. It becomes a little bit easier, you know, once you're in your 30s and 40s, you're more of a fully formed, certain person. You're not trying to figure it all out, right? And you need to choose wisely. And that probably is a much more precarious choice when you're making that choice at 20 than 30. By 30, you've done a lot of that development on your own, and probably, you know, your partner's influence isn't nearly as great. But when the earlier you get married, and it's not as much early as you understand about who you are, the more you're going to necessarily rely on your partner.
We had the Princeton mom, Susan Patton, on our show a couple months ago. She wrote a book called Married Smart: Advice for Finding the One. And what she recommended to women in particular was marrying young men that they meet in college or soon thereafter, that women are at their top of their game in terms of attractiveness and can find a choose a better mate, one that's smart and successful. How do you feel about recommendations to encourage women to marry younger and also to try to find their partner in college or among a very bright cohort at work?
What I could get on board with is finding a partner in college is helpful because it's like a big dating pool that where everyone there has been pre-selected to be similar to you on lots of different traits. And so I say this to students a lot where it's like, you never in your life are you going to be around so many other people that are similar in age, similar in interests, similar in life, you know, stage and those types of things. And so, you know, that's, it's helpful in that regard. The problem goes back to something we just mentioned a few minutes ago is, you know, how well is yourself developed when you're in college, right? You know, if you're particularly meaning first year versus your senior year, I mean, that those are vast differences. I mean, it, you know, how much students figure out who they are during college is profound. So, you know, insisting that you find your partner in college and saying that that's going to be superior to other ways, I think that's a pretty risky bet. I also think that the one aspect of something you mentioned in there was this idea that, you know, women are at their physical peak and that's going to help them attract a better partner. No one should want to attract their partner based entirely on their physical looks, right? Because if you're relying on your partner to like you for how you look, you're asking them to like you based on something that inevitably over time is likely to decline. You want your partner to love you and respect you for who you are and the kind of person you are and how you treat other people and, you know, all those types of qualities and characteristics that are only going to age with grace and get better over time and not be so superficial about it.
In your opening remarks, you mentioned that we do a lot of work to improve our golf game, but we don't work on relationships nearly as much. Another comment that Susan Patton had on our program was that, you know, a lot of women really focus on their career development, but they don't spend as much effort on seeking a partner or on maintaining and improving their relationships. What sort of emphasis should we place on finding our spouse? How much time should we place on working on our relationships, and how do we compare that with working on our education and career development in comparison?
You want to think of, you know, some of the key areas of your life going forward and where your happiness and well-being and fulfillment are going to come from. And so, you know, that's a big reason why people choose wisely in many cases to focus a lot on their careers. But you can make all the same arguments for your relationship. And so it's certainly an area that you have to pay attention to. I think you're going to find better relationships when you're not necessarily looking for them, because you might be trying too hard. I think the best thing for people to do in terms of finding a relationship is really, you know, foster that sense of self-understanding, like become comfortable with who you are as a person, really focus on your self-development. Be comfortable being alone so that when you're in a relationship, it's because you want it, not because you need it. Be really confident and comfortable with who you are. And the good relationships will find you. And, you know, it doesn't mean you can't go looking for relationships, but to the extent that you're clear and confident about who you are as a person, you're going to be less willing to tolerate bad partners. So too often people are willing to stay in bad relationships because they think any relationship is better than no relationship, and that certainly isn't the case.
We had a special episode on internet dating. The opportunities are unbelievable. How do you think about choice internet dating and how it affects short-term and long-term relationships?
You know, one of the really big positives, if people use them well, is you have a lot more information about people up front, right? So if you go back to my earlier advice or suggestion about making your partner your best friend is somebody who shares a lot of the same interests. So if you use a dating app wisely, you have so much information that you can really tailor your potential partner to be much more like you. You know, it's the choice and the number of choices can also lead to some really bad behavior. You can start adopting this, you know, relationship shopping kind of mentality where, you know, hey, I found you, you're really great. You know, you're an 8 out of 10, but there's someone over there who might be an 8.1 out of 10. Ditch you and try this next thing. And, you know, you can kind of get spoiled by the number of options and think that there's always going to be a better choice.
In your opening remarks, you mentioned being selfish in relationships. What you mean by that and how to both preserve and achieve personal growth within a relationship.
We have this overly romantic notion that the key to relationship success is to be completely selfless and give ourselves completely up to our partner, right? And just kind of step back and let our partner take hold. The problem is that the research doesn't show that that's the case, right? The research actually shows that when we engage in self-sacrifice, it's worse for our relationship. Our partner doesn't necessarily appreciate it, and the relationship outcomes aren't that great. And so we need to use our relationships as a way to become a better person. And so if we're constantly stepping back and not looking for things to foster and grow our sense of self, we're missing out on a key source of self-growth that we need to sustain ourselves. Sacrifice is kind of an interesting thing in relationships because the research shows that when we make sacrifices for our partner, we become more committed, right? And that sounds good. We have a stronger bond. The problem is we're not necessarily happier and we're not necessarily closer. So we have this stronger bond to someone that we're not necessarily happier with.
In your book, you talk about relationships where one of the partners goes out of town during the week. And so there's a significant distance between the two partners. And in those relationships, you mentioned that sometimes it makes the heart grow dearer and the relationship works out even better. One of the interesting aspects about this COVID situation is that many people are now working from home and they've quadrupled down on the amount of time they spend with their partner or in close proximity. How should we think about this change in behavior as it affects relationships?
Yeah, I mean, it's been one of the big predictions about the pandemic that has ended up to be completely wrong. And that is, you know, early, you know, March of 2020, the big prediction was, oh my gosh, we're going to be quarantining with our spouses, so the divorce rate is going to skyrocket. The reason why long-distance relationships are strong is because those relationships have to focus on good communication, and it's not as much about the physical, passionate love kinds of aspects. One of the things that the pandemic did for us, you know, for those of us in good relationships, is it gave us more of an opportunity to spend time with someone who's likely our best friend. And so what could be better than spending time with your best friend? Now, you might argue a little bit more, but arguing in and of itself isn't necessarily bad for relationships. That's communication, right? That you're helping to, you know, advocate for your own point of view and better understand your partner's point of view. And so you're going to have those little points of friction. But the research also shows that those little points of friction are much better than ignoring them, which is much easier to do when you don't see your partner all the time, and then allowing them to accumulate and then eventually blow up.
Obviously, in life, in any relationship, there's going to be trouble. And it's important how we deal with it. And I think the more similar we are in our backgrounds, the better, because when we see that curveball, we could say, oh, you know, how, what are we going to need to do here? And at least we agree on a common understanding. How should we work together to face the troubles of life?
I think that last point is you nailed it, right? It needs to be, anytime you and your partner have a problem, there's some point of conflict, you need to think of it as not me versus you, right? You know, arguments shouldn't be about confrontations and who's the winner. Instead, it needs to be you and me versus the problem. And so the problem might be a misunderstanding. It might be, you know, some sort of difference of opinions. And so it's you and I versus the problem. Every time we have an argument or some sort of conflict, we have an opportunity to grow closer as a couple. Because once we kind of travel over that ground and go along that journey and kind of puzzle it out together, our relationship should be stronger as a result. Now, that isn't how most people think about conflict, right? I mean, the number of times that people will mention to me something along the lines of like, hey, I know I have a good relationship because my partner and I, we never fight. It's a bad sign. Because if you're not having conflict with your partner, it means you're somebody is actively trying to avoid it. And a lot of times, what the research shows is that the couples who believe conflict is a bad sign, they actually have worse relationships. And the people that believe arguing shouldn't be tolerated, they're less satisfied, they're more aggressive with their partner, right? And so as much as you're trying to save the relationship by not fighting, you're actually creating a much more dangerous situation because you're allowing these 10 little things, which if you had dealt with each of them as they came up and, you know, kept the small problems small, wouldn't be any threat to your relationship. But if you let those 10 things accumulate over time, that can create this potential for a major fight that could threaten your relationship.
In the book, you mentioned that Barack and Michelle Obama went to marriage counseling, that they have a great marriage, but like all great marriages, there's friction, and sometimes you need a third party to come in and help. What do you think the role is of counseling to improve marriages, and why do you think that the Obamas going to marriage counseling is a sign of strength, not a sign of weakness?
They seem to be very supportive of each other and enjoy each other's company. And so the fact that they made it known that they went to counseling, I think is one of the ultimate signs of strength because it just shows that relationships aren't perfect. And so to learn that relationships take work is a really important message to get out to people because, you know, it's like I said in my opening, people spend very little time learning about relationships. You know, we learn a lot of things kind of, you know, accidentally by the relationships we see. I think counseling or any third party objective opinion from somebody who's not, you know, immediately involved in your relationship helps give you some new insight and see things a little bit more clearly.
In your opening remarks, you mentioned that there's inertia in relationships, especially as it relates to breakups. You have so much invested in it. You're going to be alone at least for a period of time. How do you evaluate inertia, the uncertainty of the future, that another relationship will be better or worse?
Wow, I mean, that's probably the million-dollar question, right? It's really, really hard. People, when they're thinking about breakups, spend a lot of time deliberating over it. A lot of it is, you know, the simplest way is basically when, you know, look at how many good things are in your relationship and look at how many bad things there are. And you should have a preponderance of good and very few bad, right? And so if you have a lot of bad things in your relationship, that's a problem. You can start looking at other people's relationships. One of the best ways to get some insight into your relationship is to ask a friend, particularly females. If you ask your female best friend, females' best friends have the most insight into what's really going on in a relationship. And when it comes to making predictions about the future, our friends are much better than we are at knowing what's actually going to happen. And in fact, the research shows even our mom has a better sense of what's going to happen. Spend more time learning about what makes for good relationships. When you learn about, you know, what makes for good, strong, healthy relationships, and what makes for problematic, unhealthy, abusive relationships, where do you see your relationship? I think people need to be a little bit quicker to break up than they are, because we tend to think that our relationship breakups are going to be worse than they actually are. And there's research to support that as well.
We end each session on a note of optimism. What are you optimistic about as it relates to your subject, how to improve and have great relationships?
I am optimistic because I think the pandemic really showed just how important relationships are. Those really deep, meaningful, romantic relationships with a partner who is our best friend that, you know, when you're quarantined or you need somebody to rely on, having that person there to be your rock, someone to rely on, someone to help out, someone to spend time with, someone to enjoy, that I think that this experience over the last 18 plus months has really opened our eyes to seeing just how important those relationships are. I think it's going to help people see relationships as less disposable, a little bit less of that relationship shopping mentality on online dating. So I'm really hoping that this sort of helps usher us into somewhat of a golden age of relationships where we really start focusing on, you know, what it takes to have those good, strong relationships that we all deserve.
Gary, thank you so much.